welcome to the Logistics Tribe. I'm Boris Felgendreher, founder of the Logistics Tribe, and today we have a logistics industry veteran on the program. Herman Ude is the former CEO of DHL Freight and DHL Global Forwarding, a former corporate board member of Deutsche Post, and now sits on a number of supervisory boards, including his role as chairman of the supervisory board at Transporeon. Herman has a strong interest in the impact the logistics industry has on the environment and on climate change in particular. He holds some key insights into how the industry has to evolve and what role technology can play to drive down the environmental impact of the logistics sector. Please enjoy this conversation between Herman and our Logistics Tribe host, Jonah McIntyre. Before we get started, a quick thanks to our supporters, Grey Orange. Grey Orange automates warehouse operations through a combination of AI software and autonomous mobile robots. Grey Orange systems are in place at some very prominent companies such as IKEA or the Danish wholesale goods and furniture retailer Jysk. If you're looking to get your warehouse and fulfillment operations to the next level with the help of autonomous robots and automation, you should definitely have Grey Orange on your list. Check them out at greyorange.com. All right, now let's move on to the show with Herman Ude, hosted by Jonah McIntyre. Enjoy.
To get a running start at this, why don't we give you a chance to introduce yourself to the audience? You've got an amazing background. You've been through the industry for a long time in really significant positions. What were the highlights for you? What are you doing now? Give us a little bit of background on yourself.
Yeah, so maybe I don't start with the work, but with where I come from. And I actually grew up on the Baltic Sea in a village, on a 5,000 people, small place, which was an interesting childhood experience. So I'd never moved as a child, so it was very stable, and it was a lot of nature around, a little river and things like that. So that's why I have always been emotionally pretty attached to normal nature. I don't need palm trees and things like that. So just what Europe considers as the normal pasture landscapes, and that has been my upbringing. And then I studied economic business administration actually, and a bit of art history, and then joined McKinsey for 8 years, in which time my three kids were born, and then we moved to Bonn because I joined DHL as a group in a role that was a bit unspecified, because the company intended to build a logistics company, but in reality it only had mail, retail outlets and parcel in Germany. And we then acquired some 140, 160 companies and integrated. Then my role sort of was corporate architect, to really see how this integration works. And basically, if you look at the four pillars now, that was what basically the structure was that we at that time designed with the mail and the supply chain express integrator business, and then the forwarding. Then I led the European road trade of DHL, and then ultimately as a board member the air, ocean and road forwarding business, which was market leading globally, I think still is, and of course quite a stretch also for me to operate a really global business. And I think that was a fantastic time. I think, of course, well, endless highlights if you want. I think actually what I really experienced, which I thought was a highlight, was mentorship. I think from an outside perspective, it always looks like a great career and somebody has done all the right things. If I look at my own life, it has been four times people that actually said, I trust you, and I'll give you support. And I remember that when I was not yet an operating road freight, I really smashed an IT project. I think it was a 4 million Deutsche Mark at that time loss on a project that didn't deliver any value. And the then group CEO, he asked me, he got a report from our auditing department that this was a mess. And he asked me up to his office, and I was a bit sort of shaky. And he said, well, I got this report. Anything you say? I said, well, we really messed it up. It was wrong. I made mistakes, wrong judgment, and so on. I said, well, and then he finished it. I said, well, now invested 4 million in your education. And that's why we want to put you on another road, which was a bigger one. And it was, so I think that was always a highlight when you felt like there's somebody that is strengthening you and allowing you to do things and trusting you, even if there are mistakes, because there are always mistakes happening. You always make mistakes in a large organization. You oversee things and so on. So I think that really these experiences were the true highlights, and of course a lot of travel, nice things and wonderful people I met. But I think that was something that I really would like to highlight.
And your transition from McKinsey over, so at McKinsey, were you sector focused? Were you focused on?
I was assembly sector, electronics, mechanical engineering. So my customers were, yeah, basically in that space. So I never had a specific supply chain spike, which obviously changed then at DHL.
How was that transition then? Did somebody also sort of make a bet on you?
No, I think it was about general management skills, and they said, well, I think you need the next step, and there's this road freight business, and at that time it was heavily loss making. They needed restructuring and many other things. It was, I think, 100 million negative at that time, and so they just said, well, we give you the opportunity to fix it, so to say. And I had no specific road freight inroads or knowledge. The position.
You had management and business acumen.
Yeah, so why also, again, if you come to it, it's all about teams. And then I never hired a McKinsey into any of my management teams, because that type of thinking in PowerPoint and logic and figures and graphs and whatever, that was what I could contribute to a team. But what I needed were practitioners who had operated a road freight hub, who had dispatched air freight shipments, who were capable to roll out a software in 800 or whatever we had stations. So I think that's the thing, how you create a team, that you don't try to copy yourself 15 times and think that this is the greatest idea. So I needed to complement myself with the people that have the specific skills, and they were not the type of McKinsey skills. They were actually then the skills of practitioners, and as a team, then you're pretty complete, I suppose.
Yeah, I could see I could see the temptation to hire in people who are
look like you're saying.
Thinking symmetrically.
That's looking like me should be a great career. No, that's wrong. I believe it's very wrong.
Yeah, and so we're going over it fast, but it is quite an incredible career you had there. In your last role, you were leading global ocean and air forwarding. Is that correct?
And road, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and road. So sorry, and road.
14.5 billion, pretty large business. And then we had I left then 11 years ago. And the core reason for leaving was a dispute about the way how to digitalize the business. And when I left in 11, then I had 1 year gardening leave or whatever, couldn't do anything. But then I joined my brother, who had started a small company in digital learning training field, TTS, and I joined that, then became also a shareholder. There were some other partners, and one wanted to retire. So I very much got close to the IT industry. And then at one point, it made a bit click that I saw that actually the transportation, this combination of digitalization and transportation is an amazing match. Because all the problems that we solve as a forwarder, or the many of the challenges the industry has, can be resolved with digital solutions that comes from very simple ones like which are now standard, like proper routing optimization and these type of things. But also as an industry, forwarders do nothing else but leverage information. I know 50 people who have a load, and I know 30 people who have a truck, and I combine them simplistically. Now, still, although the forwarders are optimizing that, we have 30% empty capacity on European roads, about the same in North America, a bit less. And then again, a data problem. So let's approach it like a data problem. And that's how I came to then Transporeon as a chairman, and a number of other assets that I'm invested in and that I'm interested in being successful. And also at the same time, it came out that, especially with this empty mileage tick, with the awareness for the problem of carbon or sustainability in general, because we also have the degradation of our agricultural grounds. We have species losses at an enormous pace. We have and we have the CO2 heating up problem, which are all somehow intertwined. I saw more and more the opportunities that are there using digital solutions to overcome carbon or ecological challenges, and I think that's also somehow maybe leading us to this discussion, because I think it's the good thing about digital solutions often is they cost you nothing in terms of real money. They create value from moment one. But if you want to change all trucks into electric, I mean, that's I don't know what it is, I didn't calculate it. $80 billion investment program in Europe, which may be nice for truck manufacturers, but it's a massive thing over a short period of time. But implementing a solution that makes cargo and trucks visible or a solution that makes CO2 emissions visible and starts to operate, that is a cent per, or a few cents per, per shipment. So I think I more and more like that aspect of the thing, and I think that's what I try to shape into all the different ventures I'm in.
It's true that when people come from the material economy, so I maybe have a similar background in some sense, where I started in true supply chain management, material flows, financial flows, and information flows. And when you make that transition from that economy and that focus over to technology, and particularly software, so data-focused technology, the economics become quite interesting. You look at something that has really negligible creation cost. I think that what holds us back with creating software is actually the creative minds that are necessary to create it and the change management from leadership, which is necessary to implement it. But the cost of creation is not the factor. We're not rate limited by its cost. And even for things which might be quite expensive to create in their first sort of moment of being, for most of the work that we do in this sector, the computation cost, essentially the incremental cost, are not zero, but almost zero. So you have this sort of solving it once may cost something, which is a considered investment, but then you've essentially solved it from that point on. It can be duplicated or reapplied.
I would maybe reiterate a bit your thought on the two boundaries. It's mm-hmm. the cost, obviously, and it's change management is a key one. And yeah. I would say change management has two dimensions there. One is actually we decide for a solution and how do we get adoption up. So how we decide we want to roll out a certain software for real-time visibility, and how do we convince drivers and really right. the controllers to check it really and so on, and make the customers educated on using that information. So that's one adoption challenge. And the other challenge is, if you look into the digital industry, I don't know, it's not after fashion, it's the industry with the highest sales cost.
Right.
It is extremely, yes. There are solutions I have seen where I would say there is no argument to implement it tomorrow on a small scale and test it out. If I was operating, right. Be it Unilever or Nestle or somebody like that, I look at this and say, hey, this is so cool, but still it takes an enormous sales effort to get this into these large organizations. So, and I think that is another change cost.
Yeah.
So if I let's take real-time visibility. I think the real-time visibility opportunity is so obvious. It's an operational level. It costs you, I don't know, 30 cents, 40 cents per shipment. It's really nothing. So maybe you don't roll it out to the whole empire of your whatever 60 billion company in 6 weeks. But why not say test instead of argue? Yes, we do it. We want it quick. We want, and that will reduce the sales cost in the industry. If you look at all these high growth, loss-making companies in the industry, and there are many, and if you look at their cost structure, 40 and 50,
sales and marketing,
engineering. Sales is significantly more costly than engineering and operating.
Yeah.
And so we have in the industry, we have a double problem. Supply chain people tend to be, well, at least they are not the most innovative one, really grabbing things quickly or mm-hmm. experience. But what I'm wondering is why they don't just test, let them just do it. And so I think there are these two change management costs that make us too slow to bring innovation mm-hmm. and also sustainability to the supply chain operations.
Yeah. There was this moment, just as the pandemic was kicking in, I felt this moment when the metabolism of large company decision making raised for a moment. There was this probably a 6 month period where, for the first time in decades, really, I felt a breakthrough in decision making. Where previously I would meet with large companies, and if everyone wasn't aligned, they just didn't make a decision. I mean, the inertia effect was so large that you really had to kind of push on every single wheel at the same time to move the car forward at all. Yeah. And for a really brief period, as the pandemic was kicked in, so much was changing in society, not just in businesses, but in societies, that you could feel this pace of change altering. And I think there's leftover artifacts from that, things like the remote work movement, where the idea that people are going to commute 30 minutes to reply to an email or to work on PowerPoints at their desk and then drive 30 minutes home, that's just not going to be accepted at the same way that it was pre-pandemic. But to segue over to climate change, unfortunately, the nature of sort of the degradation of our environment and climate change is that it hasn't presented us with a pandemic-like rupture. And so over time, we can all see around us the effects of it, but they're not sudden. They're not forcing a change upon us. And I don't know how you feel, but I don't believe that there will be such a moment come. I think it really has to be an inward motivation to make change rather than a forced one.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, it's I agree. And the challenge with that problem is it's when we have climate change driven, the moment the spring 20 corona moment, suddenly thousands of people die and so on, it's too late. The problem is this challenge needs foresight. And that's why, because when it comes, you can't fight it any longer. It's like a big wave. Yeah. When you're standing in front of a 20 meter wave in Portugal on the sea, and you are not on your board, you're not going to make it. It's not, it's too late, and any movement will just not help you. So, that's why I'm actually surprised. That every individual person leading his her life and so on doesn't see it that way. I fully understand. We always had our vacation in Mallorca, so we fly there our short-term flight. And somehow we know that if we are doing that as four people, it's the CO2 footprint of an Egyptian for the whole year, just a flight for two-directional flight to Mallorca, which is, 1,400 kilometers. If you compare air and sea travel, it's a 10 times saving on time. So you need 4 days end-to-end from Hong Kong or from Shanghai, let's say, to Frankfurt. And you need 40 days from Shanghai to Frankfurt if you take sea. But from a CO2 point of view, it is 14 times, 15 times that. And if you that CO2 calculated, if you look at the CO2 impact of air freight emissions, they are three times as impactful, like methane is as 26 or whatever times. So three times. So in reality, it is we are trading a downtime from 40 to 4 days at a carbon at a climate change impact that is 60 times. People somehow don't get that into their thinking, which I believe is surprising. I mean, there are all, if you look at the business leaders, we have a leadership challenge here, because leaders are not expected to manage the day, but rather to expected to manage with foresight. And yes, some organizations, I got a very good blog post currently from the CEO of Heidelberg Cement, and I was quite impressed how they are doing that, cement being one of the big polluters, much smaller than road transport, but yes, big. And he basically calculates the full CO2 into every, not only investment, but in any operation in the world, so that everybody feels the load of the whatever it is, I don't know the number, 100 euros per ton. And can either reduce headcount, reduce transportation costs, or reduce CO2. In the balance sheet, his P&L would be the same. I thought that was a great thought. So some people are grabbing it, but majority, let's see, and we shouldn't be the first, and so on.
Yeah, we spoke briefly about this in the past. I mean, this sort of goes to one of the things that's close to my heart on this topic, which is if climate change really is the result of externalized cost, which the decision maker is not accountable for. For example, you fly to Mallorca, there's some cost on the future of humanity and not just humanity, all the animals and other biosphere, but you don't have to pay for that. So this results in sort of adverse decision making that you would, if you did have to pay for it, you would alter your own decision making quite naturally. This invisible hand sort of not being able to work its magic on emissions, I think is something that's quite, well, I really think ultimately that could be one of the ways that we finally take this seriously. I know that there are some companies, you're mentioning this now, there's some companies that are electively internalizing their emission cost.
Yeah.
I just don't know if they'll actually be, the thing that is challenging about this is I don't know if that works. I don't know if electively doing it from some companies actually has the effect of making the change broad scale enough.
I tell you a story that I told at townhall meetings at DHL, which is now, as I said, 11 years ago, because you had to motivate people. So climate change and also biodiversity loss is for me is a topic that is very close to my heart, but it has a very, very clear business aspect to it, because in the long run, we will have to pay for CO2 individually mm-hmm. as companies. And we don't know when it comes, and we don't know in which magnitude it will come. But the thing is, if you are on foresight, the typical, what do people do if they have a problem, a financial or an economical problem, that they don't know the probability and they don't know when it's going to hit? What do? They take an insurance. So they take an insurance. So I don't know whether my house will burn and when it will burn, but I have a fire insurance for my place. So very good. And that was the aspect. I said, if I look forward, and the story I told was basically at that time, because they were the leaders, I said, if Barack Obama, Hu Jintao, then China, President of China, and Angela Merkel sit together and they open the second bottle of Barolo and they just agree that they would tax, carbon tax, jet fuel as diesel is taxed in Germany, that would have, because in full freighter, kerosene is a massive cost line, right. Would result in a 30-40% increase in price for mm-hmm. air cargo. And air cargo is a product that you use for speed against cost, so it's an obsolete set voiding. So if you have
right.
so the bikini delivered still in August can be sold. If the bikini came by ocean freight in October, you may have to destroy it because you can't sell it in that season. So basically, or cheese or pharmaceuticals or whatever has an obsolescence. So this calculation changes if the price of the transport goes up. And if it goes up and we calculated that, and if fuel would go up by I think it would double actually with the diesel price, and then at that time, and we would have 30% less air freight in the result. And I told my people, if and when that happens, I want to be sitting on the 70% business. I don't want to be sitting on the 30% that we lose. So that's why we concentrated on, for example, pharmaceuticals and other things that we said they are always going to be important enough to be, or for a long time, to be flown, and get out. Don't fly stuff around that shouldn't be flown around. And then you're still automatic. It's a business. You can make money and so on. But I think that's the narrative that any leader should take and say, okay, if I'm not paying my premium now, I'm I don't know when, and I don't know at what magnitude I'm paying a total 100% loss in at a certain point in time. This insurance logic, I think, should lead leaders to really embrace this topic seriously. And I think if you look at the calculatable premium from 12 years ago, I would have said maybe we can put 5% of our profit into CO2s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I would run a very large operation now, I would think it's maybe rather 10-12% of my business investment. I could take different packaging solutions and really think it through, because paper is not always better than plastic, but plastic needs and so on. So really think about that. If you take a company like Amazon with the enormous amount of output, if I was Amazon, one of the projects I would start after the cloud business and after logistics is a global packaging network, or DHL could do that the same, with return packaging. You know that there are companies that do the Europallet and so on. Why is not somebody saying, it's not sustainable that we are creating these enormous amounts of paper per German, 240 kilos paper in a year.
Plastics.
Germany is the world record holder. There's no country, not even the US matches that, brackets, because they use more plastic, but and that's not sustainable. So let's create a solution. Let's invest some billion or whatever, set it up somewhere in a sector or in a country, and establish a return system for that. And I think, and that's an investment, it's a insurance premium, so that the model of internet trade stays or will survive longer, because it has an element of sustainability, and future costs will not occur to my company if I operate a more sustainable system. And I think that's something.
It's interesting when you're describing what you did with DHL. I can see the McKinsey roots. It's market selection, right? So there's some market which traditionally you'd be looking at this in terms of CAGR and growth metrics and whatnot, but you're looking at it as risk exposure to essentially a carbon tax. One of the things that I find interesting about this is that one of the adverse effects of that is that you have less. So DHL, for example, would have been out of the game on some products, maybe low value fruit as an example.
So we didn't go into flour and fruit, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, flour is a great example. So then you go, okay, so when enough participants do that, Because we see this also in investing, where certain funds won't invest in, say, tobacco or alcohol or coal, and the effect of that is that the return to the investors who do invest in there is higher. They face less competition for capital. So in the case of, for example, transport services, if there's less people willing to transport flowers, the price that they are required to pay goes up. Essentially, you could look at it as internalizing the risk factor of being in a market that has carbon tax potential. But in the short term, it creates an incentive for somebody to service that sector at a higher profit margin than others. And that's one of the reasons why I find it.
But it increases. I mean, take the flower example, which may hold or not, but in principle, you are sitting there, there's flowers produced in Kenya, somewhere on the Lake Victoria, using, which is a very, very—
which is crazy,
absolute crazy thing. Anyway, so you have the flowers and you can, and they need to be moved out. If a DHL and a Schenker and a Kühne would say, no, sorry, we don't move flowers any longer because we think it's a non-sustainable business. We don't send drugs around, we don't send ammunition around, we don't send flowers around.
Yeah.
Behind every kilo of grapes from South Africa, I calculate that once is 4 liters of kerosene. It's not what you want to do. Okay, so we are stepping out of that. Nobody else has the capacity. So that means that the transportation cost for flowers would move up massively because somebody would have to bring in something and specifically build an own flower flight network, which would operate at significantly higher cost than a combined whatever fill the load type of cost. So I think you can have an impact, but not if you are a small guy and say I don't do this ugly business. But if you are a bigger one like DHL with 13% at that time global share and air freight or so, they could change it and they could take distinct decisions on certain businesses not to operate them.
Walmart and Amazon both actually have had similar effects in their supply chains in the past. I know to some extent Unilever as well.
When you're
at that size, I know for example, one was the packaging that's used to transport chickens, so live chickens. It was something Walmart just made a decree that said, from now on, if you're in our supply chain, you have to use this other packaging, and it had a massive impact. And it's stuff like that where you go, well, that's insane. But the power of somebody who is the de facto organizer of the supply chain, whether that's because they control the demand in the case of Walmart or in the case of DHL, because they control the means of transportation, really, to your point, that really can shift the dynamics of an industry. I see that.
And I think that's why it's a lack of leadership at one end. Policymakers are not supporting it enough. But as most... all the bad things that happen are at one aspect are a leadership challenge or problem. I think the means are there in many, many cases. They're, if you really ask people, would you mind if something... Actually, I mean, to take one thing, Amazon introduced the same day delivery in Germany I don't know, 6 years ago. And what from a pollution point of view is a disaster because you really send around a truck with 10 shipments or 11 shipments.
It's optimizing away from, if we talk about empty kilometers or empty capacity, it's certainly optimizing away from that.
And you wonder what's the economics behind it. The economics behind it is that the probability that somebody is sending the product back increases significantly by the hour. So let's say I'm buying a yellow jumper, which would not be very becoming to me with my sort of red hair. I would buy a yellow jumper at an online shop, and it would be there when I bought it. The probability that I keep it is in double-digit percentages higher than if I receive it only tomorrow evening. Huh. And that's the economic spend. So it's in a way, it's our greed fueling the systems that overlook CO2 or other things. That's why pricing and taking the insurance view and so on is very important. It's really doing that. The problem is that if I take my decisions now on a risk, I calculate my risk, and let's say 5% of my profits or revenue could go to investments into sustainability, what I don't calculate is the accumulative effect of CO2. And I think that's the system's completely out of sync. I look at my investment and say, okay, that would be a payback in 10 years. It's not great, but it's okay. I will do it. But over time,
carbon's going to be there for 200,
piling up, and so there's an exponential challenge to that.
Yeah, that's one of the, you know, to go back to this. I mean, this example with same day delivery, I think is another one where my mind immediately goes to, okay, if one retailer, one e-commerce retailer does not offer same day delivery and another offers same day delivery, the motives behind that are kind of irrelevant in many cases for consumers. Not all consumers, but many consumers say, well, you know, like I like same day delivery, right? And so the next thing that goes through my mind is, well, you've got, if you had a carbon tax, it has to be internalized somewhere in the business. The business either has to make a better return on other elements of its operation, be more efficient in some other way, or it has to charge the consumers, in which case the consumers
pays for it.
Then they internalize in their decision making, do I really want? I guess another option could be to just unilaterally say, for example, in Germany, there is no same day delivery. Everything has to be delivered at least.
But you're always behind the wave. It's not. Yeah. This is just not working. I mean, you remember the EU with the big Tata announcing that straws are not ear cleaners, right. And what else? Three products were banned from plastic. I mean, for me, this always looked like a gig of the plastic industry, because they said, if we can get away for 5 years that cheap, that's really great. No, I think the regulator should not go in on that level. The regulator should say, we increase the carbon, we produce a carbon tax, we calculate carbon unwanted visible on every product like we do with VAT. So really falling through over the different levels. Yeah. So if I produce I mine coal, and that is going into steel, and that steel goes to a steel factory, and then it goes into a car, and the consumer can see this car has a footprint of X.
Right,
so,
right.
And that's the things the regulator can do. So that's visibility, and when I have it visible, I can start to influence it and can say, okay, we are increasing this. We are charging for it. We knew it before. Now we are charging, and then we get the actions. I think the regulator would be completely overboarded with lobbying and everything if he wanted to inject little great ideas into a system as big as our world. I mean, this is just not feasible. And I think we should, that's the pity that all the things that we be externalizing cost is not a capitalistic principle. The capitalistic principle is, I bear all the cost, and I try to make profit out of a better product or whatever. And there are lobbying groups or industries that are living from externalizing significant amount of the cost on the ecological side, and they have a significant lobby influence. But as a principle, capitalism directs is the strongest social construct to direct energy, forces, ideas into the right direction. If there was a price signal that CO2 is 150 euros a ton and will be 300 euros a ton in 3 years, like with no law, the things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. The price signal works pretty well for all these other scarcity dimensions or danger dimensions in our society. It moves resources onto the problems that the world wants solved. I mean, it's not perfect, obviously, but it's pretty good. And it's a bit of a shame that it isn't yet applied to this space. I think we're kind of discussing a sort of an agenda or a prioritization to get to net zero emissions and in the logistics sector. One of them is internalizing the cost. Another one you mentioned, which I'm also a big fan of, is this true sort of reporting mandate on your emissions, so that and Europe has the VAT system, other countries do as well, where we're not newbies to tracking our contributions to a product, to a value stream, or a value chain as it moves towards final consumption. We have other mechanisms for that with VAT. We could do the same thing with emissions, presumably.
Exactly.
To throw another one out there, I think the move towards net neutral energy sources is also an important one. I think one of the hard things about logistics is most of our emissions comes from transportation, and transportation, it's electric vehicles for short distances, but after that, it's liquid fuels. And that really is the handicap for if you want to move long distance, even the green options become liquid fuel, things like hydrogen become liquid fuels.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, if you really, it's not calculated to the gram, but I took the view of saying, how much can I achieve without changing the vehicles?
Right.
And that starts basically with the with looking at the what is the amount. Now, the amount we are normally looking at is the fuel burn. Mm-hmm. What we should add is of transport, let's say road transport, what we should add is, of course, the CO2 load of the truck production, producing
the asset production. Yeah.
And what we always completely forget, also the car manufacturer, everybody forgets, is the enormous amount of energy that goes into the road infrastructure, which is as much as the car production. And together they are as much as the CO, as the so the TO2 impact of these two blocks, the producing the car, producing the road, is as big as the fuel burn. So these three make it up. And now we try to get that down. 2030 target is pretty clear. So so it needs to go down, I think, by 40 in Europe and then more than 60 in 2040. And then I made the calculation and said, what can digital solutions achieve? And I assume we can get out of 50% of the empty running, 50% get that down. We have an enormous as a routing solutions currently work just with digital routing solutions currently work in such a way. This is your target. That's the route you go and you go. Mm-hmm. There was an accident somewhere. I might get a rerouting and so on.
But nobody tells
me that, by the way, the time window on the ramp has moved 6 hours back. You only have to unload tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The capacity that the three empty pallet places that I have in my back have not come back to the system and say, hey, he has more hours, more time, or he can sleep now. And so we are optimizing the system not with real-time intervention. And in a super tactical, super dynamic environment like road freight, if you really sit on the truck, I mean, there is a change every 2 hours. Yeah, we have to get to a point where we are capable to do real-time intervention on routing, on capacities, and availabilities on basically on empty available. So, and the moment we get there, my little calculation that I did, and I think I shared that in an internal transporting meeting at one time, is that around 60 to 65% of the 2030 gap could be closed with that. Mm-hmm. And we still are sitting on the same truck. There's no other engine, but we solved a big part of the problem. And this is also driving me very much into this digital space supply chain, because I believe that these solutions are much more, much stronger, and they give us the time to start really coming up with better technology on the hardware side, on the truck side, and so on. The next thing is that is, I'm not talking about the optimization from the shipper tells me I need this pallet somewhere, and mm-hmm. the carrier is picking it and delivering it at the right time at the right place. Now, from my experience at operating these businesses, there's enormous amount of moves that are not necessary at all. So the whole planning, connecting production with actually transport needs, consolidating them, changing, so they want to have the warehouse empty every day. They could mm-hmm. say, no, the part loads we leave here, we know already in our booking system that the customer ordered another six pallets for the same direction and so on. So we could reduce transport volumes as a whole significantly. I can give you a simple example. There is a very large manufacturing company, US manufacturing company, one of our biggest clients at DHL, and they had they made quarterly results as every proper American company, and they internally, the production organization needed to make revenue.
Right.
And they could only do revenue
if it had shipped,
and actually if it had arrived in the destination. So they put mm-hmm. the September 28th big machinery stuff on an airplane to move it to Chile, so that it sat there in the warehouse and was booked as revenue, because otherwise the guy wouldn't have met his target. This is not an exception. And so we need to think more real-time intervention-wise, really purpose-oriented. When do we need ship what? And that's another optimization here that I haven't even looked at. So if you think that until 32, 60% we can achieve with, or a lot of, let's say more than 50%, yeah, maybe I may be wrong in some part of the calculation, but 50% can be achieved. That's already a lot. And the costs are, $2 or whatever it may be. It's very, very little per shipment. It's not like buying a new truck or building a petrol station network for hydrogen or something like that.
What's interesting about it is they're not just paralyzed. Like, you're describing them in a way that's really beautiful in the sense that they're paralyzable. We can work on changing the platform of our transport vehicles from internal combustion engines towards hydrogen or electric at the same time as we make these improvements that really just come down to supply chain visibility, inventory optimization and transport routing and driver assignment optimization. One of the things I find interesting is that it's not just they're parallelizable in that way, which is beautiful, but it's also that for at least one of those platform changes of the vehicles, which is the move to hydrogen and electric, that requires a completely different routing mechanism for the transport planning. I sort of do a call out to Andrew Cleland from as one of the leaders at Nestle in supply chain. We were talking one time, and he said, you know, we want to see more of our product move on these hydrogen trucks. That's the best chance we have at zero net emissions in the mid mile, you know, the mid distances. But he said those vehicles, they have to refuel at, it's not like every gas station is going to have hydrogen. They have to refuel it at certain places. And as far as they know, and as far as I know, even to this moment, there isn't a routing software that's really purpose-built for that task. Because also, even if you were to say, well, you know, it's just, you just take the points, like, no, you have to schedule the stop, because it's not like they have 50 fueling hookups just waiting for trucks to come in. It's no, you book an appointment to come in. So that means that the routing software to get this right is going to have to take consideration of the product move, the site, the pickup at appointments, the delivery appointments, the appointments at the fueling station, the route through the fueling station, and the drivers, so the driver hours.
And that's again an inefficiency that you have to calculate into your hydro truck.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to see that it goes longer distances, longer routes. The car is also driving more kilometers or miles, and so the depreciation is higher. And so I think the whole system, it's a super complex system. And I think that's the thing of, the Transporeon specifically, but also other companies are looking in. This industry is about good solutions, digital solutions for a number of very small problems.
Yeah.
The problems are all, it's always a nitty gritty problem that you solve. Yeah. It in itself is okay, 10 cents, I do that. But it's, and then, if you combine these things, suddenly you come to some bigger picture. But the problem, I mean, when Mark Oliver Simon started and his friend started Transporeon, 20 years ago, they created a ramp management software. From a supply chain director perspective,
it seems like a tiny problem.
It's a very tiny problem. And yes, and there's some dispatchers on the ramp, they would say, what a shitty life I have, and always these trucks, and they always sit at the wrong ramp, and but this is the style, and then you have the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth and so solution, and suddenly these things combine. What I think the big thing is, because there are so many small decisions that a truck driver can take, that a customer can take, that the dispatcher can take, that the company can take, that whoever can take, you need to get to this level of real-time intervention. I said that. So you need to be able, the truck driver needs to get the command, hey, you have 6 hours more time, pick something up somewhere else in the meantime, or take your break. And that's the only way to overcome the complexity of an over complex system. And if you add your hydro complexity to it and say, by the way, so many driving hours and then so much rest time, and the trucks need refueling, not only when, but also where. Now it's only when. Yeah. Okay, next petrol station, and then it says yes when, but also at a specific location and in a specific time window. This complexity
it overwhelms most of the decision making apparatuses in the industry. There really is an angle to compete just on this. I mean, there are companies, one that I particularly like is called AI Fleet in the US, but there are multiple, there's Cloud Trucks and there's others, that this is their angle. They simply say, we built a company around the optimization engine, rather than most logistics companies were built first as customer service organizations. They won a customer and then they sort of figure it out afterwards, and they added technology step by step later to clean it up a little bit, to kind of improve the operations a little bit. And then I think this new style of companies go the other way. They say, well, actually the core is a tightly planned operation, and then we'll do the demand, we'll capture demand that's a good fit for our tight operation, and grow that way.
And we see that. I mean, the target of every, I mean, if you look at the target target sheet of a supply chain director of a large company, the first thing is always, did you get my shit out to the market? And then, so for, we are always, even at DHL, we are wondering and say, why don't they look for better pricing? Of course, generic in the RFT, but on tactical going a spot market or so, they were always pretty reluctant because they said, you know what, this year I'm in my budget and I get capacity so I can deliver good quality. The production organization or the sales organization will have, we always had our whatever product in the market. And that's the best thing I can get. And if I saved against the budget another 5 million, 10 million, okay, nice be it. So that's an interesting view they take. And within that framework, they just try to optimize. So the optimization doesn't really go through.
I mean, we see it, me and my team see it all the time of, Cost is really not an optimization criteria for most in the industry. We call them shippers, right? It's has to be satisfied. Once you hit the satisfaction level, which is budget essentially, then from that point on, the risk reward trade off flips. Like it will, of course, if you could just for free give me 5% savings, I'll take that. But if the 5% savings poses any risk at all to my operation, or if my team has to work any harder, or if I have to step on somebody's toes who I might need their favor from them in a future date, I won't do any of that stuff,
And that's it's again in a way a data problem, because you don't have the visibility on what the reward or what the opportunity could be, and you really don't have visibility on the pain that you make that comes with it. So that's again why data is so critical in such a micromanaged business.
I think that the fact that in the US so trucking rates are dropping, we all know ocean rates are dropping right now in Europe. I believe the predictions for recession, and that would tend to correlate with trucking rates dropping again here as well. And in these cases, I do think the silver lining is that if you're a procurement organization, now's the time when you can start making some sourcing changes where you say, well, I'm going to switch towards people who either give me lower emissions or just can report their emissions at all, And the reason it's the opportunity is you just mentioned it is, in fact, if you have to give up a bit of savings in a falling rate environment, no one really notices in the outside. No one realizes how much is actually possible to get in terms of savings. So if your savings go down, if your rates go down by 10%, but you could have gotten 15, but now you've switched to more sustainable or at least transparent emissions.
You don't have to ask your CFO for approval for that one. If you deliver 10%, you are a great guy. I think I would agree. There is these moments of change are the moments when you can change more than you actually needed to change, but you need to be prepared. I think on CO2 people should be prepared. I mean, it has been talked through in so many ways.
For decades.
Somebody says, climate change, that's interesting. What does that have to do with my supply chain operation? I would be surprised. So I fully agree, and it becomes a standard. I mean, much of our talk was about the economical side and externalization. Now it becomes a compliance topic as well. People just expect you, and it has some even say it's a third dimension next to reliability and cost. There comes sustainability. I think in the midterm it will translate into cash actually, because there will be a charge on it and so on. But getting this little advantage with your customer base that you say, okay, we do already tracking, and we do not only tracking, we also do real-time intervention. We know which driver needs more or which carrier needs more fuel. We have real data, and we are beginning to intervene and generate savings. That is a training that is part of our insurance premium that we let our carriers get. In the long run, the carriers with high CO2 footprints will lose out anyway. I mean, it's a question of time, of course, but
Or they'll be pressured into change, perhaps.
But some try to resist the pressure because they still have a customer that hasn't got it and things like that. But they will, in the end, they, it's a bit like people who said China, who's China? We don't have to go to China to make successful business. Who said that in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, 2000, 2010, they were gone.
So in closing here, are there... one of the questions I'd wanted to ask you, maybe we use this as our closing question, is there anybody you think deserves a special call out? Is there any interesting technology, interesting operators, folks who you see are ahead of the curve in this area?
Yeah, actually, I mean,
you can say companies that you're involved into. It's okay.
This is I think let's start a call out. I mean, the one is you at the beginning you need theory about it. You need people who really create awareness, and I think there's really Alan McKinnock, who's the professor at the. I think it's Kühne School in Hamburg. I think he is, and he really is leading that people. He's now invited a lot and talking a lot about it. Understand the dynamics of CO2 and so on. I think that's a good one.
Can you say the name one more time so people can get it?
Alan McKinnock.
Yeah, and so okay, we'll link to it in the show notes.
So Mac, like Scottish, and then K-I-N-N-O-N, and so he's a very really thought leader in that sense, and I think that helps a lot, at least in the European space. Don't know how strong he is in North America, but that's really somebody. From a shipper perspective, I think it's consumer companies. I mean, everybody thinks at Patagonia, who really worked on all dimensions of their system, also supply chain. I think they by taking that serious, and you need the sense of people who do it on a broad basis and people who set the example. I think that's a very strong one. And then there are some, if you look at the digital space companies, there are some companies which have great solutions. You know them. I think Trucks was CO2 measurement, calculation, and then analytics, really, that you can come to outcomes. But if it's a point solution, it's very hard. I think it's very hard to sell. I think, and in the end, it's the big platform providers like Transporeon also that will pick these services up, because they don't only give you the analytics and the data, they give you the tool to then intervene and go for another carrier or go for another route or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of the agenda, the transformation agenda that you and I discussed, the nature is decisions must be interrupted, and the outcome is a different and better decision is made, but it's very difficult to do that with a point solution that, for example, like the tracks capability is very interesting in the sense that you can do large scale digital twin simulations of a fleet.
Yeah.
That's from my perspective, that's a game changer in this, because agreed. It's one thing to retrospectively say, well, when we operated on this lane, we had this level of emissions. It's another thing to say, our fleet operating on that lane in simulation, simulating the driver and the individual vehicles, et cetera, would have this amount of emissions. That's amazing. But that, as you said, then that has to be applied to practical decisions. Decisions like, how much do I reply to in an RFQ on that lane? How many loads do I say I can take? Do I or do I not make listings for new drivers to be hired? Very concrete.
Yeah. How do I get access to additional loads, for example, to increase the load factor? And I mean, can always say I don't do anything that has a CO2 negative impact, but then I may be very limited. So how can I leverage the capability? No, I agree. And Trucks is on this inside part very strong, but it needs this real-time intervention piece. Another one is ZQ that creates something that is basically integrating the real engine data into the reporting. But again, it's a point. It's a very critical information, because now most CO2 calculations on trucking are done on a virtual assumption of what the truck is and how the driver goes. It's not the real per load type of thing. And suddenly you really get the engine information, the real information. And you could also then intervene and say, okay, this driver is doing too many hard brakes, which he then has to restart quickly. So that guy needs a driver training, but I don't need a driver training 400 drivers because others have other problems. But he has this one. And so again, that's a solution. And there are these type of people. It's mainly more or less a younger generation. I remember from DHL, which I followed. They were not in the position when I was there, but there are some people who really have a lot of energy. Katarina Tomov was then supply chain officer, and she really changed for such a big LSP significantly the way how they thought about sustainability. And there are these people in the organizations, but typically they are below 40 and not yet at the EVP level where they maybe need to be to really show how it works in their own way. But I think it's an interesting space, and it's a fabulous growth opportunities for younger people.
Yeah, it's huge opportunities. Yeah. And it's one of the spaces, I think a lot of times people who start logistics businesses struggle with this. What do you tell your friends and family? Because no one really understands how big and important this industry is, the sector is. But people get emissions and people get climate change. So any advancement in that area gets also the social rewards. It's a bit the same, I believe the same social effect of people becoming, say, a doctor or something, where there's just people respect you in a way that isn't just, well, you're earning a lot of money. They respect you because you're helping people.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, yeah.
Herman, thanks very much for your time today. We'll make sure to post a link to the researcher you mentioned and to also the companies that you mentioned. I hope to have you back another time. Maybe we can talk about success stories in a future conversation.
I hope very soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
All right. That was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Herman Uday. I hope you enjoyed today's show. If so, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.